But because that road that's, you know, maybe at capacity for maybe an hour a day, the community of 20,000 people that live around Jasper Avenue are subject to the 7-lane highway 23 hours of the day, where vehicles are enticed to drive at much higher speeds than 50 kilometers an hour. So we have a lot of speeding, we have a lot of noise, we've had pedestrians struck and killed on our road. And so that's a, you know, someone's personal transportation choice is having a profound effect on our community.
Hello and welcome to a podcast presentation of The Yard's Summer 2018 issue launch and salon, recorded live at CKUA on Thursday, June 7th. I'm Jeff Samsonow, publisher of Edmonton Quotient, an online magazine here in the city, partnering with the Downtown and Oliver magazine to bring you this conversation. The summer issue of The Yards is focused on, well, summer. Pick up a copy of The Yards at all kinds of locations in the Downtown and Oliver. Check out a listing at theyardsyeg.ca. You can also find the latest from the magazine at that website, theyardsyeg.ca. Summer means more people heading into the river valley, catching some sun at the Alberta Legislature fountains, or riding the new bike lanes. So the panel discussion for this issue focused on how people get around the core, and how Edmonton's transportation model is, and has to continue, changing, particularly with an aging population. The Summer Salon included the conversation you're about to hear, moderated by Oliver Community League President Lisa Brown, who is also an environmental engineer with a passion for active transportation. Joining Lisa on the panel are Marianne Alacock, a transportation engineer at the City of Edmonton, leading the development of a citywide bike plan; Dr. Martin Ferguson Pell, biomedical engineer and clinical scientist who has dedicated his academic career to the study of secondary complications of physical disability; Dr. Lily Liu, professor and chair of occupational therapy at the University of Alberta, focused on work with populations of older adults; and Joelle Reiniger, a downtown area resident, community advocate, vice president of the Boyle Street Community League, and supporter of grassroots community development. Now please lock up your bikes, grab a summer beverage, and enjoy the conversation.
So we have a fantastic panel, and I'm super excited to hear what kind of conversations we're going to have this evening. So I have a few, I'll call them seed questions, and I've told the panel that if they have any questions they want to ask of each other, or if they have a particular avenue that they want to go down, they're more than welcome to. And then we'll obviously open it up to any conversations or questions that you as an audience have. So just to break the ice, we're going to get started with what your favorite way of transporting yourself and your family around is. So we'll start with Lily.
Yeah. I have to say, by far, my favorite way of getting around would be walking. I walk as much as I can, and I was just telling Lisa that, in fact, when I came from Montreal, where I walked and I cycled, and the transit there is fantastic, it took me a long time to be able to live close enough. The transit would take me 2.5 hours, because I lived on Laval Island, 2.5 hours to get to university, and then to get back 2.5 hours. So I was 5 hours in transit. By then, I was pretty sick of taking the public transit, but I was too poor to own a vehicle. And even then, you don't want to drive in Montreal. So my first and foremost condition when I came to Alberta for my job interview was I told people, I have to be able to walk to work. And it's unheard of in this country to find a campus where you can actually walk, and unless you can pay a lot of money, right, for housing. But back then, 25 years ago, that was possible, and I'm so glad it stayed in our neighborhood. It's on the south side in Belgravia, and LRT came in only after over a decade. So now it's an extra bonus for us. So walking, yeah.
Absolutely, and that's something that I've actually thought about as well, as the advantages that we have here in Edmonton. Oliver, for example, actually has quite a bit of affordable housing, and there's a lot of downtowns in our country that really you can't, you know, find a bachelor pad for $400 or $500 a month and be able to walk or take public transit to work. So we are really fortunate here in Edmonton that we have employment centers downtown and at the university where it's still relatively affordable to live close by. Fantastic. Marianne.
Is this, it's on. Okay. I think I kind of have to say cycling because that's my job. But also it's true, so that's great. I think I started cycling because it was like good for the city and good for me because it was cheap and it was like a good way to get exercise. And then I learned to love it. And it's been really great kind of taking that and taking it with my family and seeing and using the new bike infrastructure has been really great because I can now go from where we live in Ritchie all the way to where my friends live in Westmount, and like the whole way is protected bike lanes or paths, and we can pull a chariot with a toddler in it and feel safe, which like a couple years ago was unimaginable really. So yeah.
Great to hear. Joelle.
Yes, I just also like to acknowledge the importance of the bike network in terms of transporting a family around in the city center. So what you've just said really resonates with me on the cycling front. I have to say though that my preferred method and most frequent method of transportation is walking. It's a healthy way to get around. It is convenient when we live and work downtown, and there's something incredibly empowering about being able to get around on your own steam.
And Martin.
So I'm what I'd describe as sort of a hybrid cyclist in that I cycle across campus, but I actually commute into campus by car. And I live in Glenora, so that sounds terrible that I just do that short distance by car. But the thing is that my lab is at one end, diametrically the opposite end of campus to where the rest of my program is. So I make several trips diametrically across campus a day. And I need to do that really fast so that I don't waste time. And so what I've done is I've got a bike and I sort of dash back and forward across the diagonal. And I'm now an all seasons hybrid cyclist in that I did this all through the winter. I think I missed 2 days this winter when I chickened out. So I really love the cycling and my situation is probably going to change in the next few weeks and I'm facing a new challenge, and that is I'm going to spend some of my time downtown and some of my time on campus. So what I'd like to be able to do is to be able to go from my home by bike downtown, and then when I need to get to campus, jump on the LRT. That would be awesome, and that's what I'm aiming to do. The one thing I need, and I'd like us to talk about if we can, is find a safe place to park my bike so I don't lose all the stuff on my bike when I park it in a downtown, you know, on a lamppost or something.
Absolutely, we can definitely talk about that because I think that's a very hot topic here in Edmonton. What I find really interesting about that is I've heard stories, well, I shouldn't say they're stories, I think they're true, that even at, say, Scotford Upgrader, they actually ride around the campus of this large industrial site with bikes because they're safer to get around. You know, you're not worried about, you know, people driving trucks into things they shouldn't. So even in our really industrial sites that are producing fuel for our vehicles, they're using bikes as their transport. So great, thank you all. So one of the questions that I wanted to start with is this idea of, and I'm glad that everyone did touch on this, that transportation for many people is just a means to an end. It's a way to get from point A to point B in the most efficient way possible. But can we look at transportation more intrinsically? You know, we've talked about, you know, it makes you feel better mentally, physically. Maybe it's fun. How can we start having those conversations as a city when we're designing our transportation systems about how to make, you know, life more joyful by imparting some fun into the way we move ourselves around? Does anyone want to get started with that one? Do you want to start with bike lanes?
Man. Sure. Great. I think you're totally right that it brings people joy. There's like a wealth of research out there that supports the fact that like people who bike to work enjoy their commute so much more than people who drive. And I'm sure that's true for walking as well. And so I think that definitely that's a motivator. And often people don't realize it until they start, right? So there's a lot of behavior change that needs to happen, and there's, yeah, so like education and infrastructure, all of that is required for behavior change and mode shift to happen.
So are we doing that right? Do we is the build it and they will come philosophy working, do you think? Or are there other things that we need to do as a city to get people walking and biking?
So build it and they will come is quite snappy, but it's lacking a lot. You have to build it in the right places and build it in a way that is appealing. I mean, people make smart choices. As long as cycling or walking isn't a more convenient and comfortable option than driving, like, most people just won't do it. So we're getting there, but it takes time, and it takes the infrastructure and the education, and we're building it all. It's just slow, I think. That's how change works.
Martin, please.
So I'd like a slightly different perspective, and that is that if you're required to use a wheelchair for your mobility and you encounter barriers, what is the impact that has on your joyful life? Mm-hmm. And I would say that it's much more than joyfulness. It's something to do with the fact that you can become seriously socially isolated as a consequence of not being able to get around, with all of the other secondary consequences of becoming socially isolated, unemployment or depression or separation from family members and loved ones, difficulties in being able to independently access resources like food. Multiple things kind of come unbundled when you have to rely on a wheelchair to get around your built environment. And so I think one way of really emphasizing the importance of what does getting around mean to us is when you can't get around.
Yeah, that's a good point, that juxtaposition. Lily, do you have anything to add about that from perhaps a senior's perspective and
definitely.
Isolation?
I think from a personal experience, and then I can go on to the senior, and it is, by the way, Seniors Week this week, so it is a sort of a timely a topic. From a personal experience, I think that, and I come, again, from a large city where the metro system or the train system is very, long-standing, has a long history, and I notice a difference, and I think we have a long way to go. One of the things about walking is that you can use a combination of walking and the train for an effective way of getting to where you want to go, plus the exercise and the relaxation of walking. But the difficulty with the stations here in Edmonton, as we have it, is that it's more of a park and ride philosophy rather than a ride and walk philosophy, which is what I think we need to focus on more. It defeats the purpose to make the population have to drive to a station, park, and even pay for that parking, and then get on to the train. So I think that's one thing. The other is, I think the experience of the ride itself, which I always see as a combination with the walking and busing, is that I think in this day and age, if you have if you have a good Wi-Fi technology incorporated, people can be so much more, they can enjoy their ride so much more, and they can also use that technology to, or access to the technology to be able to identify where they're going. Tourists would enjoy it so much more. They can locate where they are, they can problem solve where their next stop is going to be, what sites they want to stop for lunch, that sort of thing. And then I think the underground environment could be made much more enjoyable, in the sense that I think there's one downtown where we have Central, where we have a coffee, what is it called, right? I thought that was exciting. I immediately went and got my coffee there. I thought, this is nice. I don't have to go up to get something, and then I can transfer something. I thought more of that kind of environment. And then as an advocate for older adults, especially older adults who are developing cognitive impairment, many of them who already now have to give up driving, that's one element of their independence that, older generations, I think younger generations don't want to drive, so I don't think my kids will ever, they'll be on the LRT for their lives, but older adults still really are very attached to that meaning of driving. And so when they have to give it up and they don't have the finances, for example, to use Uber or Uber Assist, which I can talk about later, or taxis, then they want to use public transit. It's not a very user-friendly system for older adults. The underground environment is very disorienting. When you come up above ground with all the construction that we have, during construction, it's difficult to navigate, never mind using mobility devices like wheelchairs. You just can't even get around. Even people who are walking without mobility aids have difficulty navigating. Cyclists have difficulty navigating. But then after the construction, the sites are no longer familiar, so that's disorienting. So we really need to, I think, involve the public. in terms of focusing on innovative practices or services. I have a PhD student who's doing this fantastic national research. In a recent interview with a person who has early dementia in Toronto, he told her that he got lost. He just stood there one day and he couldn't remember where he was going, how he was getting there. He just temporarily lost it. And he didn't have a strategy in place. He didn't carry a card or a note, didn't write on his hand where he was going. So he just stood there and he asked for help, and he was treated so rudely and so aggressively, because people just see this elderly person, they don't see that he has a cognitive impairment. And he became so traumatized, he stayed home for 5 years, and was only recently able to, with therapy, develop the ability, the confidence to be able to go out and start to do grocery again. He just stayed home and let people do things for him. And I think that that's probably, if that happened to one person we interview, probably there's a lot of those cases that are happening with the aging population. So we need to do something socially, I think, mm-hmm. yeah, to make that experience enjoyable. Yeah.
That's a really good point. So definitely, I think it's abundantly clear that transportation really impacts so many elements of our life. So I think it'd be great to delve more into the conversation of accessibility. But before we do that, I just want to ask Joelle, do you have any perspectives from, you know, a family with two children living close to downtown? How do your transportation choices impact the, you know, well-being of your family? And are there any comments that you can make on, you know, accessibility? I'm assuming if you're not in stroller years right now, you've been in stroller years in the past.
We are deep into stroller years. We're a one-car family and a three-stroller family. And those are just the strollers that are currently in circulation. So, yeah. You asked about being a parent of children. This morning I was in the car. Yes, we do have a car and we do use it about 40% of the time, full disclosure. But I was curious this morning and thinking about our conversation tonight, and I asked my three-year-old whether she prefers to walk or to drive when we go somewhere. And right away she said, walk. And I asked her why, and after saying something that didn't make sense and wasn't related to the conversation, she said, what was the direct quote? Actually, I quite like the experience that's healthier. That was
profound.
So she quite likes the experience of walking around, just in terms of the chances. I think for little ones, one thing I think we don't think about as adults is what it's like to be strapped in to something to go somewhere. So from a child's perspective, I think if you're, you know, preschool age and up, just to be able to walk down the sidewalk holding a parent's hand as opposed to being strapped in and confined, I think that's something that...
isolated from your family.
Yeah,
really.
Exactly. So I think that there's... Exactly. I know. I mean, like, she'll talk to me when she is in the stroller, and then I have to wait till we get to a red light, and then I come around and ask, what was that? And she has, so it's really hard to communicate when you do have that distance. But I think it's something that's more pleasurable for us as adults, but I also think it's more pleasurable for our kids. So that would be from the experience of walking perspective. But there's another dimension to this that we haven't hit on yet, which is the community. We've touched on it here in terms of when it goes wrong, social isolation, and what that can do to your quality of life if your mobility is compromised. So when it goes right, whether you are walking or riding a wheelchair, I can only speak to my own experience living in a relatively high-density community, but for me, beyond the health benefits and the point A to point B, there is a sense of connection to my community, both the streetscapes and the patterns, and that side of it, which has certainly informed and enhanced my ability to advocate for the neighborhood I live in and kind of know it inside and out in that sense. But more important than that, there's a sense of connection to the people in the community. Because when walking is your primary mode of transportation, you tend to bump into a lot of the same faces on a regular basis. You develop a lot of these loose acquaintance-level ties with people in your neighborhood. In Boyle Street, I have a network of, probably about 50 different neighbors that I will email when I'm asking what they think about a civics issue or to let them know about an event that comes up. And the majority of those relationships were established by walking as a way to get around. And so I don't think that we can understate the social benefits of walkability as a mode of transportation.
Absolutely, and I know we've heard with the new bike lanes here downtown and in on the south side, you know, that folks are actually interacting with each other on their commutes. They're interacting with people. You know, I always wave to Luam as she rides by. I'm getting out on my bike, and she's whipping by to go to the university. So there's a huge social element when you actually can interact with somebody without a piece of glass or steel in between you. That's great.
And there's, sorry to cut you off, but on that note, if you haven't seen it already, there's an excellent TED Talk on longevity in the region of Sardinia, and one of the things that was really key in the research was the importance of weak social ties in
Absolutely.
A person's health and well-being. And so it is like the multiplicity of these little encounters that give you that little boost. In an analog face-to-face format as opposed to via social media.
Absolutely. Great, thank you. I was going to bring that up, so I'm really happy that you didn't properly cited it because I wouldn't have had the citation. So Martin, maybe I'll let you give us a sort of a grounding on accessibility and what are the major issues that we face here in the city and what are some opportunities, some, you know, I don't want to say low-hanging fruit or easy wins, but some things that we can do to make sure that we're designing cities that are much more accessible.
So when I go back to, it must have been the mid-1980s, the United States was grappling with the question of how do we create the Americans with access, Americans with, what was it called, Lily?
Disabilities Act,
ADA. And at that time, I came to Canada for the first time. It was actually to Toronto. And coming from London, UK, I was so impressed by the accessibility of Toronto in comparison to what I'd experienced in the UK. And the US was using a sort of legislative way of improving that access. And I then moved, or actually at that time I was in New York, and I saw that in action and saw the dramatic changes that occurred in the US in terms of people being able to access environment as a sort of right, because that's what ADA was about. Whereas the British approach and the Canadian approach has been much more one of a sense of community responsibility to bring about that change. And I felt that the UK hadn't done a terribly good job in that respect, and the Canada scene, from what I could see, was doing a pretty good job in this more voluntary way about providing access. And so in the mid-1990s, I went back to the UK and from New York, and I was asked to give a series of lectures. And I started a rant about British accessibility and things like parking meters, where if you had a wheelchair and you were trying to put money into the parking meter, you couldn't actually reach up to where you put the coin in. And I had this whole slew of slides of demonstrations of poor accessibility. And about a year before I was due to leave the UK to come here, they asked me to give another talk. And the guy that introduced me said, "I hope you're not as angry now as you were the first time you came." And so, as a person who didn't have a disability, but in a way was advocating, this was something that really got under my skin, and I was adopting a sort of US philosophy, which was, UK, it's just high time you legislate this, because you're not doing a good job the other way. I'm not actually much more zen about it now, and I do think that the right way to go about this is probably through community action and community responsibility rather than a legislated approach. So I'm really bought into the sort of Canadian culture way of looking at how we create accessible communities. And the question is, how do we help to inform people about where the problems are? And so I think a lot of the way we bring about action is through awareness. And if we are aware that there's a barrier and a problem, then maybe we can start to act and do something about it. So part of what I've been doing recently is to look at how we could create what I would describe as an exertion map. And so what we're able to do is look at a region in the city. So let's take Old Strathcona and where the Fringe is held, and say, how easy is it to get around in a wheelchair or with a stroller or with a walker if you're in that area and you're wanting to participate in the Fringe? And so we produced a measurement device that enables us to measure how much effort it takes in order to get around a particular area. And then you can calibrate that against your own strength, and you can say, I'm not a terribly strong wheelchair user, and so these barriers are going to be more serious to me than they might be to someone else. So this is a sort of a much more nuanced approach to how we think about accessibility than the ADA way, the Americans with Disability legislative way of looking at it. And so what I think we do need to do is to maybe use some of our more modern technologies to enable us to start to visualize where these barriers are. And so we can superimpose on things like a Google map information about how much exertion it takes, or whether in Churchill Square right now there is construction going on, and that's going to make it difficult if you're wanting to go directly diagonally across Churchill Square. You have to navigate around all of those barriers. Or one of the things I've noticed recently is that, for example, on Jasper Avenue, it's the summer season, so what are we doing? We're putting out patios. The patios are going right across the sidewalk. So if you're trying to go along the sidewalk in your wheelchair and you encounter a patio, how do you get around that patio? And maybe by creating awareness of the fact that that patio could be creating an accessibility barrier, we can design the patio in such a way as to it not become a problem. So that's how much I've chilled out on this whole thing, you know, over a 20-year, 30-year period. But I think that the message at the end of the day is that through information, through awareness, through using our modern technologies, we can engage our communities. And I think our communities are definitely interested in helping. And I think it's just bringing them together and then bringing about action. And I don't think you have to boil the ocean in the first instance. I think you can say, where are the areas in our city which are most used by wheelchair users? Where we want to start with, you know, the hot spots that we could deal with. Hot spots in terms of utilization and hot spots in terms of barriers. And maybe build it out from there. So that's the way I've been thinking recently. And I think it's practical, affordable, friendly, and maybe something that doesn't marginalize people with disabilities as much as things like a legislative approach, which kind of puts you into a category, which isn't necessarily the right thing to do.
I love that. It's similar to Strava with heat maps and getting actual data of where people are biking and putting the bike lanes where they are, actually using data to inform better design. That's fantastic. Thank you. And we're really excited to hear more about that project as you go through this summer. Joelle, I think we'll move on to you. I'm wondering if you have any examples from your advocacy efforts of even little tiny wins that you think have helped accessibility in your community. Or maybe some examples of things that, you know, need to happen that aren't.
Well, I have a
happening.
Couple things on my agenda. Okay, so in terms of accessibility, and this actually isn't a downtown community-related issue, although it is in a different way, but it's related to riding transit and having more than one small child. So we're all friends here. I can tell you this story. So our family, our youngest child was a new baby. We had a two-year-old. We were at a big box store in South Edmonton Common, and we were looking for a double stroller. And I thought, almost as an afterthought, I just better go onto the ETS website and make sure that the stroller that we want to buy is going to fit onto the bus. So I saw the dimensions, and it didn't, and the next one didn't, and none of them did, and this is a big box store with many, many strollers. And I was, honestly, I was almost in tears in this, thinking, like, how am I going to get my two children around in the winter? Because we walk to most of our destinations, but when it's cold, I need to take advantage of transit a little bit more. Like, you can't have a new baby being transported outside in, you know, 25 below for 20 minutes. And so just the thought of that barrier was really something that surprised me. It had never occurred to me. I thought, you know, a lot of people ride transit and a lot of people have two kids. So I did actually engage with ETS, who actually responded very well. They actually, it was funny, I don't think they had actually heard too many complaints from people in my situation. And we had a productive conversation about, you know, is there a way we can better communicate what types of double strollers do work on public transit to help parents who are meeting this particular transportation need. And so there, that is the first one that comes to mind from an accessibility perspective.
And that's something I'm sure none of us would have thought is the case. You think that that's something that would be pretty easy. Either the stroller is designed for the bus, which is pretty standard, or vice versa.
Well, our solution was actually to go on parenting forums in New York and see what New Yorkers were doing to get their more than one child around on transit. And that was how we found a stroller brand that would work. But it was quite the process.
And that's tough because I imagine some people, you know, you only hit so many barriers before you throw up your hands and you decide to.
Well, and it's, and it's a sensitive time. Like, I think one thing we have to remember with young families, especially when you've, you know, just welcomed a new person into the family, as well as seniors, as well as people with disabilities, there are a lot, it's already a bit of a, you have a lot coming at you at once from a lot of different directions. So I think that's even a barrier from the advocacy perspective and finding the energy to go that step and beyond and try
for
to.
Sure. And there's also affordability too. When
absolutely.
When you're looking at families that don't necessarily have the financial means to go out and find that one perfect stroller.
Well, yeah.
Well, thank you so much for that story. That's very interesting. Marianne, I'm going to put you in the hot seat. Can you speak to any initiatives that you know of at the City of Edmonton related to accessibility? Or even, is there consideration given when bike lanes are designed for, you know, for example, people in scooters or electric wheelchairs to be able to use the bike lanes versus a sidewalk because then they don't have to go up and down ramps and that sort of thing?
So I don't work in accessibility at the city, so I'm limited on that front. But I can speak to just generally, like the best practice right now in cycling infrastructure is to design for all ages and abilities. And a huge part of that is designing for something that's safe for children and for seniors and also for people with physical mobility issues. I was reading something just recently where a lot of people, like cycling is often used with people with mobility issues and things like dismounting to cross the street could be like a real barrier. And so these are things that we're trying to think about and trying to incorporate, but it's still very early stages, you know? And the all ages and abilities as a best practice for design is still relatively new. I mean, so I'm working on a project that's, we're gonna do a citywide bike strategy. The last one was done in 2009, and a lot's changed in 10 years. at the time, there was not a whole lot of priority or budget for bike lanes, and there was a lot of painted lanes. You all know the story. and so much has changed, and we're trying to figure out how to design things or bikeways that are accessible. So as part of this project I'm working on, we have our first phase of public engagement will be in the fall, and I'm particularly interested to hear about what are the challenges from the all ages and abilities perspective and what's working and not working and what we currently have. We've got a lot of new infrastructure that we're still evaluating, and how can we improve? So watch out for that. I want to hear from you.
Fantastic, thank you. And Lily, do you want to add from a senior's perspective? Or even, you know, technology, or what are some, again, like low-hanging fruit, easy wins? Is it wayfinding? Is it Wi-Fi? Is it giving everybody a GPS watch so they know where to go? You know, what are our options?
Well, you know, the more I work in technology and with older adults, the more I realize the barriers that we encounter are more often than not physical barriers. They're more attitudinal barriers, and that a lot of the things that we want to do and accomplish are doable. We see them being done in other cities, and it's this could be sensitive, but I have to say that in a lot of the work that I've done that have been stopped or where we face attitudinal barriers have actually occurred when we come face to face with discussions and debates with our leaders. Actually, for example, the city leaders. And we hear comments like this can't be done because you don't see it done anywhere else, and we prove to them it has been done and it's been legislated and this is how it happened. Can you please at least put a little bit of force on the market somehow to make it happen? And so, but I have to say that despite that, you know, we'll hear comments like, well, the reason it's not, we can't do it, or it's not, you don't see it more often, this accessibility issue addressed, is because it's ugly. And then we come back and we say, well, the reason you don't see it is because they can't access the space. And so you don't see them there. They're at home, stuck, right? And so this kind of thing goes around. But some of the leaders, though, have also been great friends of ours and have have changed my way of thinking. One city planner, for example, approached me and said, look, I'm really interested in making this happen, this accessibility. Unfortunately, eventually he took a leave and then we couldn't continue, but it's something that we're going to pursue. And he said, why don't we approach this accessibility issue from a market transformation perspective? In other words, and this is a kind of a building on what Martin just said earlier, and I really like this, and that is that if you leave the public and the leaders and the funders to and decision makers to do it, often it's not going to be done. But if you legislate, minimally, it'll be done. And that's where the issue is, though. The people will just do the minimal. For example, if there's any bill or act that says a bar over the cross of a toilet tank is what makes the bathroom accessible, that's what you'll see minimally, and you don't actually see where they're supposed to be, right? So then we move on to the next step. So once everyone does it and the market can absorb it, kind of like what we do with the incandescent and the LED lights, it was first of all incentivized. So you incentivize the public to do this. If you do this and you make your house energy efficient, we'll give you a rebate, etc. Then people start jumping on the board. Then the market starts to be able to take this on, and you'll start to see more and more business people going, hey, there's a market for this granny flat suite. But in fact, the university students that come back home to live can also live in it, or you can rent it out to their friends, and then this kind of a market then takes off, and then you mandate and you legislate it, and because you know it's doable and it's realistic and it's affordable, right? So it's just a hybrid, to use Martin's word for his cycling, hybrid way, I think, of legislating, incentivizing legislating, and then it's a win-win for everyone, and then we also create a market for whatever solution we come up with.
Wow, interesting. Yeah, that's a very interesting progression. So we're coming up close to the time that we usually wrap up. So I just want to finish with one question. It's a little bit beastly. So I've been thinking about, so a lot of times when we get into these, you know, ugly debates on Twitter about transportation choices, people say, it's my personal choice. It doesn't hurt you. Let me drive my car. Let me drive my truck. Let me ride my bike. Let me walk. But as I think most of us know that our transportation choices impact the way our cities are designed, they impact the way, you know, we influence those around us. And so I wanted to give two quick examples. So the first one is Jasper Avenue through Oliver is 7 lanes wide. It is definitely a major commuter route for folks coming in from the West End that are driving into downtown and out of downtown. But because that road that's, you know, maybe at capacity for maybe an hour a day, the community of 20,000 people that live around Jasper Avenue are subject to the 7-lane highway 23 hours of the day, where vehicles are enticed to drive at much higher speeds than 50 kilometers an hour. So we have a lot of speeding, we have a lot of noise, we've had pedestrians struck and killed on our road. And so that's someone's personal transportation choice is having a profound effect on our community. A positive change is the bike lane on 102nd Avenue. So I live on the bike lane. And my next door neighbor, his family, they do not own any bikes. and they were pretty ambivalent about the bike lane coming in front of their house. But now they are such strong supporters that this guy will huck snowballs. He has them ready in his front lawn at cars that drive down the bike lane because he realized that that bike lane is providing a buffer for his daughter so that she can play on the sidewalk and there's no risk, there's minimal risk of her being struck by a car. So I wonder if anyone has any final thoughts before we open up to any questions or comments from the audience on how our personal transportation choices really are influencing those around us and you know what we need to do as a community moving forward and embracing active transportation to ensure that we're making choices that are giving us all the ability to live our best life possible. So Martin, I think you want to start.
So I think one of the things I immediately think of when you say that is that we hear a lot about and are very concerned about the sort of the helicopter parent syndrome, and that when I was a kid, as so many people in my age group would say, we were just thrown out of the house at the beginning of the day and gathered up at the end of the day, and we used to get on with it outside and have all sorts of fun very independently. And, you know, I used to, from the age of 5, walk to school. It was about a mile each way all on my own. And then a little bit older, I used to bike all the way to school, which was probably a round trip of nearly 20 miles. And that was fairly normal. But the thing that enabled that to happen was there was sufficient critical mass that people felt safe about. It was normal and safe. And that if something started to go wrong, there were a lot of people around to see it happening. And I think what's happened is that because of the sort of car culture, we've taken people off the streets, we've taken the eyes off the streets, and therefore we've then created a response, which is what I would describe as helicopter parent syndrome, which has so many profound effects on our society. So what's exciting, I think, about, for example, the bike lane initiative, is we're beginning to see people back on the streets who are pairs of eyes, who are engaging, as Joel said, you know, you bump into people when you're walking and say hi to them. And I think that opens up the possibility that people, young people, will have much more freedom to do things in a more independent way than they have been in the last maybe 20 years.
So a separated bike lane can change the world. Joelle.
Nail on the head with that critical mass piece of it. So thanks for touching on that. I question the extent to which personal choice is a determinant of people's transportation habits. Just the way our city is designed and laid out, I think that dictates to a pretty significant extent how you get from A to B. So we are very fortunate to have found a single family home of all things, affordable if you can believe it, right in the downtown area where both my spouse and I work. That is a huge privilege where we have this luxury to be in a situation where walking and cycling is actually not just the most environmentally friendly, not just the healthiest and most satisfying, but the fastest way to get from point A to point B. Like taking the bus from my house somewhere downtown actually only saves me 5 minutes compared to doing it on foot over a 20-minute kind of span of time. And so I do think that when we come up against some of the issues associated with car dependency in our city, I think it's less a transportation problem, and I should say less an isolated transportation problem and a product of personal choice than a housing problem and the availability of affordable housing in the area where many, many people work in the downtown area for families in our city. So I think that is the critical driving factor here, is how our housing is dispersed.
Absolutely, great point. Marianne.
I want to start by fully agreeing with the housing comment. And also going back to what Martin said about just getting that critical mass, and there is a bunch of research out there that shows that the more people you have on the street cycling, the safer it is to cycle. cars know you're there, because there's lots, they know to expect people on bikes, and so, definitely it makes a difference from a safety perspective to get, like, the more people on the street, the safer it is, and yeah, I fully agree, but I also, it is more than just personal choice, like, there's a lot of situational things, which ties, I think you've basically said what I wanted to say. It's like, it's very, the choice is only a small part of it. The infrastructure, the way the city's set up, there's a lot of factors, and being able to make that choice is a privileged thing. If you have that privilege, do it. and don't be too smug about it, because people don't like that.
I think that's my favorite line of the night. Thank you. Lily.
I'll just make a comment about housing related to seniors, and then also about what we can learn from other countries when it comes to transportation. I think still, decisions are being made in isolation, and that with consultation, just, you know, not even reaching too far, but just consultation with, I think someone was talking about engaging with, this MLA in, just as an example, from Fort Mac approached us one day, and we have what's called a smart condo at the university, was just touring, and they said, you know, maybe you can help us, just give us some background evidence about where we should build the seniors' residence. We're told, we're being pressured to build it way out up on this hill in the forest so they can have serenity and peace, and they can meditate, and they can do all this. But the seniors, when we talk to the community, they don't want it. They want to be right downtown. They want to have the bank, and they want everything. They want to be right in the center. What should we do? And we gather the evidence, and sure enough, provided the support they needed to push for the provincial government to fund this right down in the city, in the core, where they can be part of everything, all the actions. So I think that's just an example of how community engagement and using evidence to make decisions is really important. The other example I would give with regard to maybe a low-hanging fruit, creative solutions we can learn from another country is, I was in a couple years ago in Bogota, Colombia, and I was looking out my window, and it was just, wherever I went, even if it was just a few blocks away, they said it was not safe. I had to take the taxi or a driver. So I was sitting there for sometimes 2 hours to go a few blocks. And before I left, I said, I can never live in the city. I don't know how you can. I think you guys all need to leave, because this is just not sustainable for your health, and they don't have a transit system, right? They don't have a train system. So then, the day before I left, the Sunday, I looked out the window, and there was all these cyclists. The streets were full, and there were runners, and there were walkers, and there were strollers on the main the road. So I told my host, what's going on? Is there a special marathon or something going on? Because everything was out there but cars and buses. And he said, no, this is what we do every Sunday. And I said, oh my God, I so can live in this city. It was just so, I went out and I walked with it, and it was safe, because I didn't feel, no one told me I had to jump into a taxi because of the masses, the critical mass was there. I totally felt safe. And I thought, this is just this rule that they have every Sunday on the main streets. So everyone else driving had to take the side streets. This transformed the city into a completely different experience. And they didn't have to do any renovation or any construction. It was just a rule they had.
That's fantastic. I had the same experience in Rio de Janeiro. It was also a very dangerous city to be around. But being there on Sunday when they closed the main road along Copacabana and Ipanema, which I only know how to say those because of the songs about them, really cool experience. And thank you for that story about Fort McMurray. That's really interesting. Again, data driving, really great design. So thank you all for coming. Thank you. A huge round of applause for our panelists. I may be a little biased, but I think this was one of our best panels that we've had. So thank you guys for coming out. Thank you all. Thank you again for coming. Pick up a copy of The Yards and, you know, share your thoughts with us. Share your thoughts on social media with your friends and neighbors. Thank you all again. Have a great night.
Thank you again to Lisa Brown for hosting this conversation, and to Marianne Alacoque, Drs. Martin Ferguson-Pell and Lily Liu, and Joelle Reiniger for sharing their thoughts and insights on transportation in the summer and all year round. As always, there were some great questions from the audience after this main discussion, but instead of boring you with my voice interpreting the off-mic inquiries, just let me promise we'll get those recorded properly in the future so you don't miss any of the insights and takeaways. And make sure to grab tickets to the Yards Salons so you can hear your applause and laughter on the podcast. Thanks to the team at The Yards for their help in this podcast partnership. Thanks also to Sona Shavda for producing the panel and salon, and Andrew Williams for technical support. The conversation continues at theyardsyeg.ca, where you can check out the summer issue, and at downtown and all of our businesses listed at theyardsyeg.ca, where you can find a copy of the magazine published 4 times each year. Thanks for listening to this podcast, a partnership of 2 of Edmonton's local journalism publishers, The Yards and Edmonton Quotient. You can find more stories, podcasts, and community items at theyardsyeg.ca and edmontonquotient.com. And hey, if you're still listening, why not consider doing what you can to support more Edmonton journalism by sharing this podcast, sharing the stories from the new magazine, becoming a paid supporter of Edmonton Quotient, or even buying ads. You can also volunteer with the Downtown and Oliver Community Leagues, which help publish The Yards. I'm Jeff Samsonow. Thank you for being part of the conversation.